Hello all, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. My name is Chris Malmberg, and my co-hosts are Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. As per the usual, we're discussing a novel this week, Billiards at Half Past Nine by Heinrich Böll. This one is a German work from the late 1950s that takes place entirely on one day in 1958, with multiple viewpoint characters casting back upon the trauma of the preceding decades. It is a story about the injuries that remain long after the war has ended, motivating further violence. As always, we'll study it both on its own merits and in the light of other books we've read for the podcast. The events of the book take place on one day in 1958 in Cologne, Germany. Each chapter follows the thoughts of a different character who inevitably finds themselves thinking at length about the past. And that is how we get the story of the first half of the 1900s, leading up to and through the world, both world wars. It's sort of a mess to try and summarize each of the chapters and their points of view in the order they appear in the novel, so I'm not going to try to do that. Instead, I'm going to lay out what happened in the past and what is happening in the present of the novel. For the most part, the story follows the Fommel family of architects. David and Joanna Fommel, I'm going to call them Grandpa and Grandma Fommel for the sake of simplifying things, are the oldest members of the family, and it's Grandpa Fommel's impending 80th birthday party that anchors the current events of the novel. Grandpa Fommel is very respected locally for the many buildings he erected throughout Cologne and for the work he did as an engineer in World War I. Grandma Fommel is in a mental institution, unable to recover from the pain of losing their older son, Otto, first when he became a Nazi and then again when he died on the battlefield. The deaths of her daughter-in-law, another son, and various anti-war activists during World War II also weigh on her. Their architectural consultant's son, Robert Fommel, is probably the closest thing we get to a protagonist. He's in his 40s, and he's built really nothing. In fact, he secretly much prefers to demolish buildings, not erect them, after he was somewhat forcibly conscripted into the German army as a demolitions expert. Robert's son, Joseph Fommel, is a sort of hopeful young architect, is overseeing repairs to St. Anthony's Abbey in Cologne, which was destroyed in World War II. The abbey is Grandpa Fommel's signature architectural achievement from when he was a hopeful young architect himself. One of the secrets near the center of the novel is that Robert, remember that's Grandpa Fommel's son, and the closest thing we have to a protagonist, Robert is the one who is responsible for blowing the abbey up. Now, the backstories through which the characters' musings take us are again and again full of loss, resentment, hatred, and unanswered questions. Robert seeks to reconnect with one old friend, Skrella, who was persecuted as a radical pacifist, while he avoids another old friend, Nettlinger, who willingly joined the Nazi cause. Joseph wrestles with the revelation that his dad blew up Grandpa's abbey for seemingly no reason while the war was winding down, and drives super fast with his eyes closed, scaring the shit out of his fiancée, calculating when he has to stop and turn by counting in his head. Grandma Fommel plots to murder her son's old gym teacher, who she blames for seducing Otto to Nazism. Grandpa Fommel quietly struggles to piece together the vision he had for his future with the present he finds himself in. The last 20 pages of the novel are sort of bonkers, considering how slow the first 270 are. Everyone starts to gather for Grandpa Fommel's birthday until Grandma Fommel pulls out a gun and shoots somebody. I can't quite tell who she shoots. She just seems to shoot somebody because she decides at the last minute to not kill the old Nazi. I think it's a politician having a conversation nearby that we overhear a little bit earlier in the book. Also, Robert completes the paperwork for adopting the young hotel concierge who waits on him while he plays billiards and then rescues the boy from a very weird globetrotting female socialite who appears out of nowhere and wants to basically kidnap the young concierge for what may be optics or sex reasons. I can't tell. Finally, Grandpa Fommel gets his birthday party, with his wife being carted back to the sanatorium, the shot politician being driven to the hospital, his few remaining family and friends gathered around him. He seems weirdly upbeat until the cake, a replica of St. Anthony's Abbey, is revealed, at which point he balls up his fists as though to destroy it, the way his son destroyed the real St. Anthony's, before relaxing and asking for a cake knife. Okay, so I'll start by asking, what did you guys think, and did I miss anything that matters to you in that summary?
There's a way in which this book, it's grappling with this issue of this incredible, incredible scale, right? The whole kind of question of why did Hitler occur, and how do you, you know, I mean, this was, you probably said this earlier, but this was written in about 1958, right? So why did Hitler occur, and how do you, in 1958, come to terms with the fact that that happened, right? How do you, as a German who lived through the war, in many cases both wars, how do you kind of come to terms with that fact? And it doesn't really have any answers to either of those questions, right? Because it's probably still too close to the thing, you know? And it's very important, I think. I understand why Bull wanted to grapple with those questions, but he's ultimately writing about characters who don't really have compelling answers. And so it, you know, it's dealing with this issue of incredible scale, but it's dealing with it on this very kind of granular level that is so granular that I think it becomes dissatisfying for people who have much more historical remove and who want a more cohesive statement, right? And I think that the, like you, it was one of those novels, and I feel like we cover a lot of this type of novel on this podcast, right? It was one of those novels where any individual sentence or paragraph was interesting and well-written and had kind of a welcoming quality to it. But the overall effect, I think, was, it was fantastic as a sentence level experience, and the overall effect felt perhaps inadequate to the purpose that I would have expected from it. But at the same time, it feels incredibly unfair to expect it to be adequate, right? Like it's, and I wonder if kind of the, there's not even a thematic weight to the kind of inadequacy of how it grapples with the questions it has. So I liked it, but I didn't love it. This was what that boils down to, I guess.
Yeah. Could you describe what you were kind of expecting from it?
Well, there's two questions, right? Why did this happen? And how do we, why did this happen? And how do we move on from it in a way that allows us to construct a thriving society, right? How did this happen? Why did this happen? And how do we move on from it in a way that allows us to regain purpose and unity as a society and begin, you know, cultural, economic recovery without losing a sense of accountability and justice? And it doesn't seem like any of the characters ultimately have answers to those things. And that's, you know, I think that it doesn't seem like any of the characters ultimately have answers to those things, but it also doesn't seem like it comes down on any kind of side of saying, well, those are unanswerable, or that's an unanswerable question, or that's an impossible task, right? So ultimately it's both uncertain about the questions you would expect it to address, while at the same time not really kind of fully committing to that lack of certainty.
I think I would sum up my feelings about this novel as a softer version of my feelings about the movie Primer, if you guys have heard of it.
It's a
you know, for the audience, it's about a couple of guys who discover time travel, and they use this time travel in this weird competition that ends up like they're trying to one-up each other, and, you know, it's a very confused plot. And, you know, basically, I recall everybody saying it was genius and not having that feeling, but also have the feeling that I must be missing something. So I've seen it 3 or 4 times, and yet even after the 4th time, I was still unable to even understand the basic premise of how time travel worked in the movie, and like the very basic stuff, I still had to consult a synopsis for the film to understand it, even after watching it 4 times. And so my reaction to this novel is a softer version of that. I feel that there are definitely like some really awesome elements. For example, the absurdity of an architect who's never built anything, kind of being a demolitions expert in World War II. That's like a fantastic idea. And I wish that the novel had explored that theme, or really any theme, in a cogent, readable manner is kind of, you know, all I really have to say. Like, I don't like the, like, I'm not sure what any overarching themes are, and I'm not sure how the strange technique of moving from first person narration to another person's first person narration without really any hints that we're moving, without, like, you know you can get it if you're paying enough attention, but I'm not sure what that does.
I think Primer is an interesting comparison, because, like, I think, so, you know, with Primer you can offer the defense of Primer that the incoherence is in fact part of the point, right? That these
right
the characters in the movie have, like, traveled a day backward in time to cheat the stock market or whatever so many times that their experience of the world is unraveling in a way that is similar to our experience of the film.
Right.
And that's that's one of those things that it's a good point, and it always feels like a bit of a cheat to me as a defense, you know?
Right. Yeah.
You can excuse an aesthetic flaw by saying, oh, well, it's meant to do that for this particular narrative reason, right? And I think that's structurally kind of similar to the argument that I was making a minute ago about this book, right? Which is that it doesn't really seem like it answers the questions you would expect it to answer, or even commits to a viewpoint on the answerability of those questions, but maybe that sense of impotence in the face of such a catastrophic evil is in fact part of the point. Or is
right.
that, and so it becomes very hard to distinguish between, I suppose it's just kind of at some point it becomes just a matter of sort of gut level aesthetic inclination.
Right.
Whether you're using these things as praise or as excuses for what are in fact just things which maybe could have used an editor or some other voice to kind of come in and say, no, let's tighten this up. Let's, you know.
Yeah.
You made the point of the switch between different narrators, right? Different first person viewpoints. I also had an immense amount of trouble with viewpoint and perspective this novel. And I have to wonder if that's less a question of any kind of deliberate aesthetic technique and more just, I mean, it wasn't written for people in 2020, right? I mean, this person wrote expecting a reader with a certain level of attention span and commitment that even very, not to like kiss my own ass here, right? But he wrote expecting a certain level of attention span and commitment that even like a very dedicated reader in 2022 just can't really do anymore, you know?
I don't mean this to be like a necessarily like a criticism so much as just my reaction. Like, hey, there are people who think Primer is a work of genius. I say it's incomprehensible and unwatchable, but whatever, you know. And same goes for this. Like, only a little less. Like, I think there was more to latch on to here, but still not enough for me.
Does it, do you feel like if you're able to situate it in a time like when people have more attention, a longer attention span, less things distracting them, and they can invest more time in reading it than just 2 weeks between podcasts, that there's something that he is trying to attempt, or is it just sort of like is it less intentional than that? I did feel, as I was reading it, there's a couple of effects of the structure for me. I'm really glad, Patrick, you pointed out the Roberts being an architect who doesn't build anything and just sort of secretly likes blowing stuff up and mm-hmm. really can't explain why he wanted to blow up St. Anthony's. And he actually like names other cathedrals like in town that he's like, oh, that one got away, you know. Mm. And it's like, that is cool. And I had that feeling multiple times throughout the book where I was like, oh, this is cool. Like,
right. Yeah, definitely.
Like, we got to Skrella and I was like, oh, like this guy's cool. Like, this guy's interesting. And like almost sort of like the feeling that you get when you're reading something and then it starts, you know, like a chapter or two and it's like, oh, okay, here we go. And I had that several times with this, but none of them felt like they really like culminated. And then it got really confusing at the end for me. Like, I'm not sure I understand what happened at the end, because a lot of the viewpoints sort of crammed together there, and it gets a little bit confusing. I don't know. I don't know what it's trying to do. Do you guys have any sense, or is this just a stylistic thing that we probably can't explain?
I mean, my instinct is to say, I think a lot of the time, and I don't really have any great support for this beyond just kind of gut check, you know, but like sometimes people write things and it seems to them like it should be easy to follow because it's all in their head. And mm-hmm. then it's not as easy actually for a real person to follow. And it's not like somebody's trying to be obscure. They just don't have a great kind of spirit level for what is and is not going to be obscure. Particularly to somebody who's coming in, you know, without any prior knowledge of the events or the characters, right? And I think it's a little bit different.
This isn't the Sound of the Fury.
That's exactly the comparison I was about to make.
Yeah. He's trying to he's like, if you're reading like in the beginning of each chapter, like when we jump to Grandma Fama, within the first few sentences, she mentions like the sanatorium. There's like several instances of that. It's like, I'm trying to give you the information. Sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, no. I was just going to say it particularly, you know, sometimes when you're reading something like this with this level of obscurity, it will be something like, and I was exactly going to say Sound and the Fury, something where there's prior knowledge you're probably going to have of what's happening and where there's just kind of this very good scaffolding of resources you can turn to, right? And I mean, I guess at the very least, like, Wikipedia's got a pretty decent synopsis of this, but it doesn't give you a whole lot why in the synopsis, you know?
Right.
No, and it's funny. I don't like look to the synopsis. I actually have the Wikipedia open right now to have it at the point of view section, so that I can keep track of who, of the order of POV. Just have like a little cheat sheet there for like who is talking and when.
Well, and when I was younger, I would have regarded it as dishonorable to use those kinds of resources, right? I would have thought that I needed to engage with the text in a vacuum, at least the first time through. But I mean, in a situation like this where I have to try to say something intelligent about it and I've got 2 weeks to bone up, there's, you know, I'm pragmatically kind of less bothered by that kind of thing.
If you were a mountaineer in your younger days, you'd be climbing like Everest without any oxygen and stuff, you'd be one of those purists.
Yeah, like Hillary, Edmund Hillary.
So the I'm going to jump to some more thematic like analysis of this because I think before I jump to that, was there a particular section or thing that interested you, Hans? Patrick mentioned Robert Fommel and his peculiarities, and I feel that way too. Was there anything that stood out to you in the novel?
What was up with that sheep lady? That just kind of felt that felt beamed in from some other universe or some other type of novel.
at the end with Hugo.
Well, she comes up at the beginning too. She appears pretty early on in the novel. She has like she has like a circle of people all sitting around like huffing boxes of sheep dung.
I missed the dung part.
Yeah, pretty early on in the novel, there's like this part where the sheep lady is like sitting. She has like a circle of followers, and they're all huffing sheep dung. I'm gonna see if I can find it. I might just like look for this in the background while you ask the next question. Actually, unless Patrick has a scene he wants to fix on.
Well, and she's also. Toward the end of this, I really got confused and I obviously missed the sheep dung part, but she's also at the tour. They're looking at sort of the Roman burial place that was exposed by actually some of Robert's demolitions, and she's there too, right? She's like one of the people in attendance to that at that, but yeah, her trying to abduct Hugo at the end is truly bizarre to me, and it's bizarre in exactly the type of way that like Patrick, I would be the insufferable person who would say who had not understood Primer, but in my lack of understanding would admire it.
Like, sure,
you know what I mean? Like, sure, yeah. Like when someone just some like weird character in the last few pages of a novel pops out of nowhere and tries to abduct a child in this truly bizarre way, I have this like very unfounded instinct that the novel must be like,
sure,
I must be genius and I must not be getting it.
Sure, yeah, I get it.
What about for you, and I thought about this with you in particular, but like, what about for you the not using, like, Hitler is never mentioned.
Right.
Hindenburg is mentioned repeatedly and cursed. The word Nazi never appears. And there's instead this use of the term host of the beast. The people who are kind of buying into the Nazi cause are taking of the host of the beast. And then there's this idea of lambs being kind of the peaceniks or the anti, those who are not really like joining in. And I felt like that was trying to do something and I wasn't sure what it was trying to do. And I thought about you because it felt like it was trying to say something, but I wasn't sure what it was trying to say either, other than that, you know, the Nazis were evil and being a lamb meant getting the shit kicked out of you all the time.
It's like the first thing that comes to mind is it's a biblical reference, right? The host of the beast, the host of the lamb. So were there other biblical things that popped up? Like, you would think that would make sense if there's some kind of biblical motif going on, maybe one that we haven't identified yet. Like, maybe there's a Christ figure somewhere, or maybe there's a Satan figure somewhere. Is there anything like that that we can think of?
The sheep lady? I don't know.
Oh, is she a lamb? Or is she a or is she a beast? Or
Hugo
both?
Actually refers to her as a shepherd. The shepherd, which is weird because then Robert's also called a shepherd. I don't know. I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I don't either.
I found the part I was talking about. If you want me to read that, just
Go for it.
As long as we've returned,
I
want to
hear about the dung being smoked.
Let's see. She held audience for her disciples of both sexes, dressed like her, legs crossed, knitting. Every now and then, opening the little boxes of sheep dung supplied them by their mistress to sniff. as if the contents were expensive scent. At regular intervals, the sheep lady cleared her throat and from her perch asked in a girlish voice, "How shall we redeem the world?" To this, all her followers, men and women, responded, "Through sheep's wool, sheep's leather, sheep's milk, and through knitting." Needles clicked away, then silence. Again, the girlish voice threw out a question from the couch. Where does the world's salvation lie concealed? In the sheep. Little boxes were opened. Turds rapturously sniffed while flash bulbs explode and reporters' pencils raced over pages of stenographic notebook.
And this is jumping to the end. Like, this is four pages from the end. And
the thing I just read? No, that's from like page 15. Okay.
No, no, and I'm jumping to the end where she appears again, and like Hugo, the concierge, is weirdly kind of, he feels like he's sort of like people like look at him a lot because he's very cute and people say that he looks like a little lamb, and it's like he feels like everyone. It's like he's a human in a society of vampires. Like he just like the brief time we spend in his viewpoint. Like, he's conscious of how people just sort of want something from him. But basically, that's all, like, dropped. And we don't spend any time on it. And then four pages from the end, the sheep lady who smells sheep dung basically follows him to his room and says this, "Open the door, Hugo, open the door. I won't hurt you and I won't frighten you anymore. You can't leave. I know you haven't got a father. I know very well you haven't. I need you, Hugo. You're the only one they're waiting for, Hugo. And you know it. You'll see the whole world, and they'll lie at your feet in the best hotels. You won't need to say anything. You'll only need to be there. Your face, Hugo. Come on, open the door. You can't leave. It's not for my sake, really, Hugo. Forget all I've said and all I've done. I was just desperate. It was just despair made me do it. Come now, Hugo, for their sake. They're waiting for you. You're our lamb." And I hear that part, Hans, that you read, and that part that I just read, and it's like, God, I really want to like this book.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing. There are these, like, awesome passages like that and the one Hans read. Like, I totally agree. Like, hearing those, you're like, I want this book to, you know, I want to like what's going on here.
Hans, did you have any feelings about the lamb, host of the beast, biblical references? Did that feel like it was amounting to anything for you?
Well, I'm not necessarily very good at picking up on biblical reference kind of stuff. Like, my brain is not wired to recognize that.
Yeah, because you're a Baha'i heathen.
Yeah, exactly. As far as the, I mean, the fact that the H word and the N word aren't used, right? That seemed reasonable to me just because they're so, at the point in time that this would have been written, it still would have been such a shadow, you know, such a weight, such an inescapable thing that it would have been redundant to use the term, right? It reminded me quite a lot, actually, if you want to compare it to something else we've covered for the podcast. We talked a little bit when we read No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood, right? We talked a little bit about the fact that the name Trump is never used in that, even though, you know, the idea of his influence on the world is kind of this constant sort of background tension in the novel. And I think
it's a really good point.
It's coming from a similar place, right? Where everybody's so sick of the word that it makes them feel like they just ate too many donuts. And B, it's so taken for granted as kind of a background condition that there's no need to say it, right? And the whole kind of host of the beast thing, it just happens to be, you know, the euphemism that Bull settled on, I suppose. I don't know if there's something to be made of kind of the way that idea or, you know, metaphor oversimplifies things, right? If maybe it's deliberately oversimplified, if maybe I think you had asked the question early on if there are any sheep, right? And the sheep lady. I'm not sure exactly what the sheep... I feel like the sheep lady must be symbolically quite important, or almost allegorically quite important even, right? But I don't know if I can quite... I feel like maybe if I had a better grasp of German politics in the late 50s, I could give you a better sense of what it is that she represents, right? I mean, clearly she represents some kind of like... Boy, I used the word clearly, and that was a real foot-in-mouth moment. But
clearly, what did she represent clearly, Hans?
Well, a corrupted version of anti-corruption, right? Something that presents itself as a force for virtue, which is, in fact, a new kind of evil. And... I think, right? I mean, in a very strange kind of comical way, but still. And
I like
so,
that. I like that a lot.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll stop there then, because I was trying to move on with the thought, but it ran a little bit out of gas.
Well, I think, you know, the Grandma Fommel, we overhear a conversation between politicians talking about some kind of deal. That probably does make more sense if you're more familiar with German politics, especially like in this period, and probably like maybe even specific things that happened. But it seems as though her fixation with the past and shooting this now 80-year-old former gym teacher who briefly was a Nazi and did do terrible things, and might deserve it, shifts suddenly to something that is actually, she's actually shooting somebody who's in politics now. And it does seem like the novel that is so invested in looking at the past is turning suddenly at the very end to say, like, you know, this, it's not like this is over, right? Like the, basically, the host of the Beast has been replaced with something else. I'm the book that this reminded me of was Waterland by Graham Swift, which notorious one-star review on our
well,
very
for
own
for me anyway.
Podcast. I think it kind of got. I think we all three of us, like, and Hans and I, were surprised by how little. We liked it, but you really hated it,
yeah,
Patrick. And this is similar in that I think it is. It's interesting. I think you mentioned, Hans, that it's too close to the past to really kind of encircle it with any kind of thematic understanding. You know, and I think that really makes sense because I think like the host of the Beast, Lamb stuff, the kind of strange, elevated. Things that are happening in this novel feel like a kind of a mythologizing of what was going on too. And, you know, Graham Swift's Waterland, there is a mythologizing of the past that ultimately seems to be saying the past is unknowable and almost unreal, almost like folklore. And then Bowl, I don't get that sense from this novel at all. I feel like everything should coalesce into or distill down into specific things that happened and specific reasons why they happened. But there's something else here that is, you know, I think talking about our relationship to that past. And I read that personally as like the past is never over. It's just here constantly and it's choking us to death and we will never escape it. So Patrick, you hated Swift's take on the past. Did you have a reading on the past as presented by Bull, and what did you think of it?
I think you summed it up pretty well. Like, it's always with us, but and it's choking us. That seems like a reasonable assessment. Like the past has a grip that never lets go. So You know, like, I won't say that, like, I enjoyed this book, but, like, I don't have any active hatred for it the way that I did Waterland. But it's interesting because I think Waterland is aesthetically better than this, because its form and structure feeds back into its thematic thematic conclusions in a way that I don't think this book really does, or at least if there is some parallel between the structure of Billiards and its themes, I'm not sure what they are. But I would still say that I actively hated Waterland, whereas this I didn't actively hate. I don't felt like I got it. But I probably hated Waterland mostly just because I didn't, like, I found its, you know, I just disagreed with its view of history. And, you know, want to be more optimistic about history in the vein of Eiffelheim, maybe. And this strikes me as kind of in between those novels as far as like its view of history. Like, it certainly doesn't think that history is unknowable or that it's just folklore, but it's certainly not aspirational about history in the way that Eiffelheim is. So
Waterland felt smug to me, right?
And maybe
maybe this is lateral to the point you were trying to dig into, Chris, but like Waterland had essentially like a ludicrous story and a bunch of one-dimensional characters, and it presented them with such gravity and authority and just kind of droned on and on about this crap. And there was a smugness, I think, that came from the kind of unearned authority in the tone, right?
Right.
And this doesn't have those flaws. I mean, right. I think the big difference between this and Waterland is like Waterland seems as though it, even though the ultimate point of Waterland is that history is kind of chaotic and unknowable, I suppose, it still kind of in some way feels as though it actually has mastery of history, right? Paradoxically, right? Like, there's a way in which Waterland kind of feels in like it feels like it believes it's in charge of itself and its understanding of the world. And this book does feel, Billiards at Half Past Nine, it does feel like it. I don't think that Bowl would tell you that he wrote a masterpiece here, right? And I don't know anything about Bowl. I could be totally full of shit there, right? But like, it feels genuinely confused in a way that is much more appealing than Waterland kind of saying that it feels confused while in fact being arrogant and smug.
That's
a good assessment.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's a really good assessment. I wanted this book to, and I found this book just in a bookstore, and I had no idea what I was going to pick, and I found it, and I, you know, read some of the stuff about it. I read the afterword before I read the book, in my copy by Jessica Crispin. And I wanted this book to tell me what it must have felt like to be sort of seduced by Nazism, and then to explore that in a reflective way after Nazism had been, you know, like stamped down. And I thought, like, that must be very interesting. I didn't really get that. The one Nazi that we get closest to, Nettlinger, is kind of portrayed as a pig. Like, he's just not really that interesting or compelling. You wouldn't, like, feel... He is not charismatic enough to sell the idea of Nazism, and I obviously am not pro-Nazi, but I'm just interested historically, like right now we're in this time of nationalism and xenophobia, and I wanted to read something that crossed that boundary and then reflected on it. And I think, you know, going back to like that initial point that you made, Hans, that you were reading this book and I was reading this book kind of wanting something from it. That's what I wanted from this book. And I am sort of fundamentally disappointed that it seems really interested in exploring the domestic sort of drama of like a small town, of a town of people who know each other being torn apart, kind of like Civil War. People kind of, brothers going to the Union, brothers going to the Confederacy, fighting each other, that it's not really actually very interested in doing anything beyond vilifying the people who eat of the host of the beast. And I think, I don't know if that's fair of me. I mean, obviously Bol is the one who went through the experience and he should be able to tell the story however he wants, but I can't help but be disappointed that I didn't get that sense of, you know, what is it that was so seductive to Otto? You know, Otto is someone that all of the characters reflect on, and they just seem totally mystified by why he became a Nazi. And obviously, like I said, I don't want to replicate Nazism at all, but I think that it is actually kind of useful in sort of like exploring why some people do become Nazis, you know, and I don't know. That's a fundamental sort of flaw criticism I have of the novel, I guess, that it is invested in the domestic arcs of these characters and how this experience tore people apart, but it's really kind of drawing that line so morally that it doesn't actually sympathize with the people on the other side enough for us to understand why they went that way to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that your point about Otto is a really good one, right? Because, like, it seems to me like there was just something in Otto that would appeal to, right? There are certain personality types who have a soft spot for a particular kind of appeal, and Otto happened to be one of those people. And maybe if that's bothering us, maybe it's partly because there's something scary about asserting that it is in fact so irreducible, right? That there is there's a certain vulnerability in certain personality types for that kind of thing. And there's just nothing else to it more than that, really, you know? It's like if Otto ate a bunch of sugar and got fat, you can, you know, there's not really much to do to solve the question of why did this child eat a bunch of sugar and get fat? You know, kids like sugar, and somebody came along and said, sugar, here's some sugar, you know, here's candy. And it's like it seems like to the extent that there's any kind of causation offered at all in the novel, it's no more complicated really than, you know, Nazism is a kind of sugar that some people really want to eat. And there happened to be the opportunity to eat a lot of sugar. And it's terrifying to have it. We don't like it being framed that way, because there's absolutely nothing you can do about that, you know, other than work really hard to make sure that nobody's selling sugar. Mm, but it's like we want it to be. We want the solution to be more complicated, because complicated solutions seem, paradoxically, I think sometimes a complicated solution can be actually, there's a feeling of power that we can get from unlocking a complicated problem to find a solution. And sometimes when the problem is simple and the answer is simple, that's more terrifying because it's actually disempowering to understand that it's a simple problem, because sometimes simple problems don't have solutions. You know, it's like every experience I've ever had with therapy, like one of the lessons has been that my problems were so simple that I was unable to articulate them or recognize them because I thought that they should be more complicated. I thought that they should be more intricate and dynamic, but it was just, I'm just sad. I'm just a sad person. That's that. That's all there is to it, right? And somehow that's a more frightening realization.
I think that that's a really, I think that's a very lucid description, and it does kind of, if there is a kind of an unintended sort of quality to the novel, you know, the idea of the host of the beast and the lamb and the mythologizing of a past before you even understand it, it does feel like a super trauma experienced by multiple people that they can't fit into whatever complicated schema or, you know, frame they've developed to kind of make sense or peace with it. And, you know, that's good. I like that.
Well, and it may be that, you know, if you were to come to Heinrich Boll in 1958 and say, well, why did Nazism happen? Why did Hitler happen? It might be that at that point, you know, we were talking earlier about having the shadow of it so close that you don't need to say the name. I wonder if also the why of it would have felt so obvious at that time that offering an explanation would almost kind of feel insulting or silly, right? Like,
sure.
Everybody must have understood the appeal of it on a very fundamental gut level because they had lived the appeal of it for decades, right? And you didn't, I don't think that, I wonder if in 1958 you would actually not have had enough distance from it to understand how inexplicable it was. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah, I really like that from a German perspective. That's obvious in retrospect, like why, if you were writing this for a German audience, then, you know, that definitely changes how you refer to both Nazism and Hitler and all of it. Any last notes, anybody?
Not me.
I hope that I can come back and read this again sometime when I'm not structurally obligated to rush through it.
I feel that way too. I think that there are places where I really liked the grandma and kind of like the mode that it gets into with her, and I thought that reading through hers, is there, why do you feel like, why do you want to return to it, Hans?
Because I think that it was written with the expectation of a more attentive and thoughtful reader than I was. And anytime that I don't click with a text and I feel like it might partly be a failure of my attention and generosity to the text, I don't like that.
Well, there you go, everybody. That's Book Spider. Book Spider. that's Billiards at Half Past Nine by Heinrich Boll. I think Patrick, you were kind of cool on it, but you didn't hate it.
Yeah, I didn't hate it.
I liked it. I think Hans and I are similar. We liked it. We feel like there's more to it. We respect it. If you read it and disagree with all of our points, send us hateful messages over social media. So whose turn is it?
I believe it's mine.
What are we reading, Hans?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is... Billiards at Half Past Nine is a novel about trying to understand and reckon with the history that you're living in a time when you don't necessarily have the perspective to fully do that, right? And it made me think about another novel that I read recently that is, I think, also about the experience of trying to understand and reckon with what we're actually living through as history, although on a much smaller scale and in much more nuanced ways, I think. And I've been interested in bringing this book into the podcast since I read it, but we had done another book by that author quite recently, and I wanted to give a little bit of space. But it is, I think, thematically a very different work from the one that we read on the podcast. Thematically and stylistically a pretty different work, although you guys might disagree. But anyway, all that lead up out of the way, I want to read and talk about the most recent novel by Dana Spiotta. It's titled Wayward, I believe.
Mm.
So that is my pick for next go round.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. Next episode, we'll be discussing Wayward by Dana Spiotta. Thank you to Hans and Patrick for talking about Billiards at 9:30 by Heinrich Böll. Until next time, see ya.